Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We will begin with an assessment of last night's second presidential debate and speak with Norman Ornstein, a contributing writer for The Atlantic and a columnist for National Journal, as well as an election eve analyst for BBC News. The author of It's Even Worse Than It Was, he joins us to discuss how much our political discourse has been lowered by Donald Trump, whose rancorous rhetoric is egged on by his hate-filled handlers, David Bossie, Stephen Bannon, and Roger Ailes, and the moral crisis Trump's candidacy is creating for the Republican Party, in particular the GOP's evangelical wing that professes to stand for family values, which Trump's lewd statements make a mockery of in the recently released video from Access Hollywood. We will also look into efforts to get the reality TV mogul Mark Burnett, an evangelical Trump supporter, to release outtakes from The Apprentice that are said to be even more incriminating than Trump's sexual boasts to the Access Hollywood host. Then we'll examine the role of the corporate media in the behind-the-scenes activities that went on before the incriminating Access Hollywood tape was released to the public by David Farenthold of The Washington Post, even though the parent corporation of NBC News, Comcast, owned it and had it in their vault. Robert Jensen, a professor of journalism at the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, joins us to discuss the role of corporate lawyers and executives in stifling the news and blowing a scoop, as well as the behavior of the alpha male Donald Trump on stage last night with his chorus of Bill Clinton accusers in the front row who claim to be victims of a sexual predator while supporting a sexual predator. Then finally, we will look into the extent to which the GOP is relying on Vladimir Putin and Julian Assange to elect their candidate Donald Trump president, and Trump's obvious reluctance to criticize Putin, who is accused of war crimes for bombing civilians in Syria, which Trump defended. Stephen Pfeiffer, the director of the Brookings Institution's Arms Control Initiative and a former special assistant to the president and senior director of Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council, joins us to discuss the former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev's warning that the U.S. and Russia have brought the world to, quote, a dangerous point, and that I do want to say that this needs to stop. We need to renew dialogue. Stopping it was a big mistake. And joining us now is Norman Ornstein, who's a contributing writer for The Atlantic, a contributing editor and columnist for National Journal, and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He writes a weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out, and is an election eve analyst for CBS News, and the author of numerous books, most recently the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann, with an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was, now out in paperback. Welcome to Background Briefing, Norman Ornstein.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And the consensus about last night's second presidential debate is that it wasn't so much a question of who won the debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, but that the American people lost, and that it feels like a scandal is now metastasized into the highest levels of our political life. What was your take on it, Norman?
Before the debate began, I did a tweet that said this will be the first debate ever that needs a 7-second delay. And afterwards, I was hoping for a 90-minute delay. It's pretty bad. And we've had instances in the past, obviously, where scandals have exploded and they've made a difference in campaigns. But this is a different at so many levels, Ian. It's different primarily because we have a presidential candidate in Donald Trump who doesn't fit any of the expectations that we have for a major party nominee for president. We don't have a candidate who's trying to expand his party's base to win over more voters. We don't have a candidate who has spent any time at all on policy, who knows less about any of the details of public policy than, frankly, anybody I've seen on the public stage or the political stage in almost 50 years. We have a candidate who I just saw a news story, said at the debate last night that we don't have any idea if Russia's doing any hacking. We don't even know if there's hacking. And it turns out from multiple sources that when he had his intelligence briefing as a presidential candidate, the intelligence community laid out in some detail the evidence that they had of Russian involvement, and since then, with much more detail to his staff, and the people who run the intelligence community are beside themselves because of his, as they put it, willful misrepresentation. When you've got all of that, and then you put it together with the kind of divisive language and apparently odious behavior, it's something that kind of breaks all of our molds. And it drags the campaign down to a level that is pretty embarrassing at home and even more embarrassing abroad.
But is that to say, Norman Ornstein, that it also drags down Hillary Clinton because of the, you see the headlines, they say, you know, scandal and the tawdry nature of the tone of the debate, and they don't differentiate it. I think it's pretty clear that Donald Trump himself is lowering the bar and lowering the tone of the conversation, and that his very presence, and he's surrounded by extremely aggressive and even malevolent advisors who are very combative, like David Bossie, Stephen Bannon, and Roger Ailes. And it just seems to me that there's a real clear source for the nastiness, but because of the way, I don't know, what is it? It's like the old expression from a Marine Corps instructor I know, that if you wrestle I can't use the word, to the ground, you end up smelling like.
Let me first note that you haven't mentioned Rudy Giuliani, Chris Christie, and Newt Gingrich among his advisors,
right.
And there are many others. We have another story from last night, and of course, Trump tried to turn the focus on the lewd tape from 2005 back to Bill Clinton and then Hillary Clinton, including, quite astonishingly, holding this press conference a half an hour before the debate with Paula Jones, Kathleen Willey, and Juanita Broderick, along with a woman who, at the age of 12, was raped, and Hillary Clinton, who didn't want to do it, was appointed the public defender for the man accused of it, and she did her job as a lawyer, he was exonerated. But all of that aside, what we know now is that on the advice of Stephen Bannon, who was behind this whole exercise, they tried to get these four women seated in the family box, an elevated box at the debate, so that Bill Clinton would be forced to walk past them and shake their hands or not. And Frank Fahrenkopf, the Republican co-chair of the debate commission, basically said, no, you're not going to do that. And if you try to put them in the family box, which is for family only, we will eject them. So we're talking about the kinds of tricks that are anything but presidential. But, you know, to your larger point, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was a brilliant man and a brilliant observer of our society, coined the phrase some decades ago, defining deviancy down. And that's where we are. Now what is viewed as normal behavior in a campaign that would have been just explosive and disqualifying some decades ago. And it does drag everybody down with it. And it's not just Trump, we have to say. It's also a larger mass media, including these tribal media, bloggers, a lot of talk radio that's tribal in nature, where the culture has been so coarsened and the language so awful that even when you have a presidential candidate who, and this was the seminal moment to me in the debate, who basically said that if he's elected president, he will arrest his opponent, the kind of thing you expect from a banana republic, it just gets shrugs.
Well, I was struck by the extraordinary moment where Donald Trump said that Hillary Clinton has so much hatred in her heart. And you could see her sort of, you know, her reflex, like, what, you know, and what I sense is that this Trump campaign is hate driven, and there's a collective pathology. I didn't mention the others that you mentioned, the Rudy Giuliani's. Yeah. They're a little less hate filled, but it does seem that Bannon is driven by hatred. Bossie is definitely driven by hatred, and Roger Ailes apparently is a very bitter man, for because of the exposure about his sexual harassment and getting dumped by his friend or former friend Murdoch, Rupert, because the sons. This is what gets to me. Do you understand the hatred that these men have towards Hillary Clinton, and at writ large, because they've been successful in convincing a good chunk of the public that she's a hateful person?
Well, I you know, I'm not sure, to tell you the truth, that it starts with a hatred for Hillary Clinton. I think that is an instrument of the larger hatred that's being pursued. And, you know, look at some of the outrageous things that Trump said during the primary campaign about some of his opponents. And then as soon as they endorsed him, he was so warm towards them. I could imagine a set of conditions where, under other circumstances, he would be supporting Clinton if it fit his own larger ambitions. What you see with Bannon, I think, and what you see with the publication that he ran and which he is still basically in charge, is racist and anti-Semitic headlines and language on a fairly regular basis. There's a divisiveness here, but they're digging into an underbelly of American society that we know has always been there. If you go back and read the books from several decades ago of the late remarkable historian Richard Hofstadter about anti-intellectualism in American life, and really about this kind of dark sentiment, you'll see that we had it before. But what you have now with the modern media age is the ability to exploit and generate it in a different way. And Donald Trump is more than willing to do that. And what we saw at the debate last night was no effort to move away from it. And indeed, you know, we had this question from a Muslim about Islamophobia. And it's true that Trump started by saying, well, I'm against Islamophobia, but then went on to basically commit Islamophobia and not distance himself from the idea that he would keep Muslims out of America, even if he now has renamed it extreme vetting, or that there would be a religious test for people coming into the country. The language that he's used on race has been deeply divisive, but there are a lot of people out there unsettled by the economy after the financial crisis, angry at the changes that are occurring in the society that are making it more diverse. And he can tap into that and expand it. And last night, what he tried to do was to activate and motivate that base, first to keep the Republican Party from continuing the drumbeat to try and force him off the ticket, but second, to just double down on a strategy that's based on getting that sliver of voters behind him and not caring much about the rest of the party that he says he belongs to.
Well, the other aspect, though, that puzzles me about the damage that Trump is doing to his own party, yet not that he's necessarily always been a Republican, but nevertheless he's their standard bearer. I don't understand, and your colleague at The Atlantic, James Fellows, coined the term Vichy Republicans. And I don't understand the behavior of Paul Ryan, for example, who had a conference call with his caucus today, apparently was fairly fractious. And he's basically saying he won't defend Trump, but he won't unendorse him. I don't understand that kind of lack of moral fortitude here within the party, between those that, I mean, look at the vice president himself. He was absolutely insulted last night by Trump. He was given the back of the hand like he didn't count, he didn't matter. And yet, in this craven way, he sends out this this sort of sycophantic tweet saying how great Trump did. I find this behavior kind of sickening, really.
You know, let me start by saying a friend of mine a couple of months ago said that if there were going to be a movie about the speaker, maybe they should call it Saving Ryan's Privates, which I think is a lot of what we're talking about here. The speaker and so many other Republicans decided a long time ago that they were going to stick behind Trump because Trump's support is a narrow slice of the larger electorate, but it is a very substantial slice of the Republican Party's base. And they were hoping that they could avoid alienating that base while also mollifying, at least to some degree, the rest of the party and, you know, hope that other voters would just resonate to the change desire and theme. And that's obviously not working. And the events of the last few months, and especially of the last several days, have put them in a more and more untenable position. And now I think there is a genuine fear among the top Republican political operatives that they could suffer a meltdown where the Senate will be gone at least for 2 years, and the House will be potentially gone, which was amazing to even consider a few weeks ago, and that all of these people out there, if they abandon Trump now, will lose that Trump base. But if they don't abandon him, then everything that he says and does, and one thing it seems to me, Ian, is very, very likely, and what we've seen with episodes in the past with people like Roger Ailes or Bill Cosby, there'll be more revelations to come. There are going to be women who didn't want to step forward, having been treated in a vile fashion by Trump, because they didn't want to be labeled or get caught in the crosshairs, who now are going to be more encouraged to do so. We know that there are more videotapes from The Apprentice with outtakes and behind-the-scenes stuff that are very likely to be explosive. And if you stuck with Trump to this point, even if you're trying to say, well, I'm not going to endorse him, but I'm going to support him or I'll vote for him, then you get stuck with that. And there are Senate candidates like Roy Blunt in Missouri, Richard Burr in North Carolina, Johnny Isaacson in Georgia, who are now in that terrible position. And you could see from the statement that John McCain made after the tape came out, which basically was put all the blame on him, don't blame the rest of us, that there's a, to say it's an unease would be to understate it. Panic may be closer to it.
Well, just in closing, though, the gatekeeper for these tapes that you just referred to, Norman Ornstein at The Apprentice, is Mark Burnett, who is, he and his wife have made it clear that they're quite, they wear their religion on their sleeve in that evangelical way, and that's the part of it that's extraordinary. He's apparently, in effect, defending Trump or doesn't want these tapes to come out. But that exemplifies the dilemma that the so-called religious right has. I mean, how can you be for family values and support somebody who's an anathema to family values?
You know, Jerry Falwell Jr. Just a week ago said that Trump reminded him of his father. I'm waiting for somebody to ask him, what parts of Trump remind you of your father? But obviously this is a real challenge for evangelicals who presumably believe in a different set of values than Trump has displayed or exploited. When it comes to Burnett, he's threatened to sue anybody who leaks or releases a tape or a transcript. We know that, just like Donald Trump, Burnett has had a stringent non-disclosure agreement with all the people who've worked on his reality shows. And there's a penalty, I think, of $5 million if you're caught violating that agreement. But we also know that, one, there's a crowdsourcing effort to raise $5 million. And that it wouldn't be at all surprising if a Mark Cuban or somebody else says, anybody who comes up with something will take care of you. My guess is, with that and with the possibility of having stuff come out anonymously, along with the possibility of other women, that we haven't seen the end of this. But it's also important to note before we end that Vladimir Putin, Julian Assange, who are obviously working closely together on this, have a continuing desire to create turmoil in the American political system, doubt about the way our system works, and to undermine Hillary Clinton. So the next month is going to be very interesting in the Chinese and depressing sense.
That's like a curse, right?
Yes.
It is a Chinese curse, right? May you live in interesting times. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time, Norman Ornstein.
Oh, sure, Ian. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Norman Ornstein. He's a contributing writer for The Atlantic, a contributing editor and columnist for National Journal, and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He writes a weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out, and is an election eve analyst for CBS News, and the author of numerous books, most recently the New York Times bestseller It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann, with an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was, now out in paperback. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the role of the corporate media in the behind-the-scenes activities at NBC, where they managed to blow a scoop that the Washington Post David Fahrenthold was able to deliver. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Jensen.
Always great to be with you, Ian. Thanks.
Well, thanks, Robert. And there wasn't a great deal of constructive dialogue on display last night in the second presidential debate. What's your sense of how, even though really it's clear that Donald Trump has lowered the tone here, that by extension, just being on the stage with Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton gets slimed?
Yeah, it's, you know, we wouldn't be the first to comment on the sort of unbelievable nature of this election. It's not that in U.S. history there have never been demagogues or people who appealed to racism or other kinds of, you know, abhorrent behaviors. You know, I was just thinking a lot about Huey Long and Father Conklin. Go back to the 1930s and you know, people then using the radio as opposed to social media, perhaps. But the same kind of appeal. There's a populism at the core of it, just like there was a populism to Huey Long. And then there's a nativist, ugly part of it as well. So in some sense, there's nothing new in American political history. We see lots of examples of politicians appealing to the worst of our nature. That said, in recent decades, I'm 58 years old in my adult life. I can never remember anything like this. I think your point is well taken that once Donald Trump was nominated by the Republican Party, there's no way to avoid the slime in some sense. I was watching the debate last night, and although I'm no fan of the politics of Hillary Clinton and that wing of the Democratic Party, I couldn't help but feel sympathetic, because there were times when you simply couldn't imagine a response from Hillary Clinton that wasn't demeaning to herself, demeaning to the audience, demeaning to the whole process. So, you know, everybody's saying the same thing for good reason. We are in this very strange moment. People call it the reality TV campaign, image-driven, you know, driven by anger more than by reason. All of these things are true, and I think it's left a lot of us just scratching our heads.
Well, the expectation is, of course, that there'll be more to come. Obviously, it's so ironic that the GOP is depending upon Vladimir Putin and Julian Assange to win their election from Putin's guy, Trump, which Hillary Clinton tried to point out last night. That in itself is an extraordinary irony. But there, so you'll have this drip, drip, drip from Assange, from all the stuff that the Russians hacked, trying to hurt Hillary. And then you're going to have probably more and more, assuming that there's enough pressure building on Mark Burnett, the evangelical Trump supporter, who's the reality TV mogul, who's sitting on all of the outtakes from The Apprentice, which insiders say are even more damaging than the Access Hollywood tape. So apparently they're even going to we were just talking to Norman Ornstein about this. They're going to crowdsource. Somebody's trying to crowdsource the $5 million that Burnett has threatened to sue anybody in because of these non-disclosure agreements that he forces his employees to sign. So there's
a lot in what you just said. Let's go back and recognize, I have no idea if Vladimir Putin wants to see Trump elected. My guess is that the Russian leadership is happy to see America flounder. If I was Vladimir Putin, I wouldn't want Donald Trump in the presidency. How do you conduct international affairs with somebody like Trump? If I were Putin, I'd probably be thinking, let's let the Americans bloody themselves and let's hope Hillary gets elected, because at least she's rational and I can deal with her. But I'm no more interested in reading the mind of Vladimir Putin than I am of Donald Trump. You also mentioned Assange, and I think it's important to for those of us who consider ourselves on the left, progressive, whatever it might be, to be able to hold our own side of the fence accountable. And I think Julian Assange has, in many ways, acted incredibly irresponsible in recent years. There was a dump of data from Turkey that exposed, you know, hundreds of thousands of ordinary citizens, their private information. This sort of claim that transparency justifies the release of every bit of data anybody can get their hands on, I think is simply untenable in the modern world. And I think we should be able to call that out. You know, Edward Snowden released information in a much more responsible and prudent way. Journalists working with Snowden, Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald, I think, have been responsible. So we can make these kinds of distinctions without, you know, agreeing with the reactionary wing of the U.S. political system. But all of this leaves us, again, sitting with an election where it's hard to know what to say. It's easy to be disgusted, harder to I think, find the analysis to understand what's happening. If, to the degree we can, I think what this should help us think about is the nature of a system in collapse, not simply a clownish, you know, detour from an otherwise healthy political system, but an entire system that is, you know, I don't want to sound like an end of days rapture spouting Christian evangelical, but systems that are in serious decline on all fronts, politically, economically, and of course, most crucially, ecologically. And in such a world, maybe it's just that this kind of buffoonish show appeals to people because the reality of facing the systemic problems is just too overwhelming for lots of people.
Well, what you just mentioned, Robert, of course, is in many ways is what propelled the candidacy of Bernie Sanders, the disgust with the status quo, and also propels on the right-wing populist side the support for Donald Trump. There's a universal distrust and disgust at the status quo, and it's pretty extraordinarily hard for somebody like a Hillary Clinton who represents the status quo to get any tractions. I mean, she's certainly lucky to be running against Donald Trump. But given the work that you do as a professor of journalism, what's your sense of this, the corporate legalism of these corporate lawyers in this vast media empire known as Comcast, NBC Universal, where apparently the Access Hollywood tapes, people that worked on them remembered the Trump incident. They brought them to the attention of the executive producer, Silverman, of Access Hollywood, and it got to the attention of the head of NBC, Andrew Lack. But then the lawyers got their hands on it, and while they were dithering around, and apparently Silverman of Access Hollywood, he wanted to take credit and be the first to release them because they were generated by his production company that does Access Hollywood, and he wanted to release them today, the day after the debate. And then I guess what happened was somebody on the inside who was disgusted by this corporate dithering slipped it to David Fahrenthold of the Washington Post, who then put it online. And then shortly thereafter, NBC was sort of shamed into putting it out online. It just, I guess, is an example of what corporate media is all about, right?
Right. Well, that's the account you just gave is certainly plausible. I would assume that's, in fact, exactly what happened. And there are kind of two interesting lessons in this. One, as you point out, our journalism, in this case, NBC News, these news outlets have long been part of larger corporations and now part of even larger conglomerates. Comcast started as a cable company. So the bottom line pressures that have always been present in commercial journalism, and it's good to remember that even in years when we might have been happier with the practice of journalism in the U.S., there's never really been a golden age of U.S. journalism because U.S. journalism has largely been a corporate, commercial, for-profit, money-driven enterprise, and there are always limitations. What you're pointing out is these limitations are now exacerbated in the particular economic climate we're in with these conglomerates. And what we might call normal norms of journalism kind of go out the window. That's one lesson to learn from this. The other, I think, is important in the more of a cultural sense, that so much media, including network television, cable television, the movies, is, I would use the term, sexually corrosive. That is the routine presentation of objectified female bodies for sexual pleasure is so routine at this point that I wonder if there weren't producers who remembered this Trump interview or heard it or reviewed it and simply didn't recognize that it was something different than the normal, you know, as Donald Trump himself called it, locker room banter. It wasn't locker room banter, as many people pointed out. It was an admission that, call it sexual assault, just call Donald Trump a sexual predator. Let's use that. That's kind of a generic term. It was the confession of a sexual predator. And when sexual predators run for high office, I think that's a legitimate source of public conversation. It's something we should talk about. And this isn't a partisan claim. I think Bill Clinton was a sexual predator. And although that was used by the Republicans to try to undermine a presidency more than hold men accountable for their sexual aggression, you know, these are reasonable things for people to discuss in public. And if we had a more, I think, radical and robust feminism that was strong in this country, they would be. So this little episode tells us something about the business of media and also about the content of media, where it's gone in recent years.
Well, I think you're touching on, surely, the connection between power and sexual predation. I mean, it's probably... psychologists could probably give us a diagnosis here of why so many politicians have this sexual aggressive or powerful people or moguls or whatever you want to call them in Trump's case and in Clinton's case, and just this general idea of narcissism and power, this sort of toxic mix and what it produces. I mean, I'm always amused by all these characters out here in Hollywood who have to go into counseling because of sexual addiction, which seems to me to be one of the most ridiculous notions in this kind of world. Because let's face it, ordinary folks, they may be sexual addicts, but they can't practice their addiction. But movie stars can, and people like Donald Trump, and that's exactly what he said. I can do anything because I'm a star. Yeah. I can grab, and then you know what the rest of it is.
Yeah. You know, I've already said I don't have any particular insights on how to explain all this. So let me point out one thing that I have trouble understanding. Of course, everybody knows that Trump was trying to intervene in the debate and create a ruckus with these four women, three of whom had been the victims of Bill Clinton's sexual predation, and one of whom had been a young rape victim in a case that Hillary Clinton litigated. And so Donald Trump had a press conference in which these four women, who all have a legitimate claim against patriarchy in the big sense and individual men who victimized them, right, not only saying that forthright, but then pledging their support to Donald Trump, who's done the same kinds of things to other women. It was surreal in a strange way. So, and to the media's credit, it didn't make a big deal out of that. But to the, I think, shame of the media, a lot of those claims about Bill Clinton's sexual behavior were treated as mere titillation and never really investigated.
They were investigated. The guy was impeached, but, for God's sake. I mean,
no, he was impeached, but the tone of it in the media took on this sort of more scandal-ridden titillation. And any time, and here's what I think is so important, any time there is an individual case of, in this case, male sexual aggression, men acting as sexual predators, especially men in positions of power and authority, what we should do in the media is highlight how this is a systemic problem in a patriarchal society. But instead, in this sort of carnival-like atmosphere, it becomes fodder for, in a sense, scandal in the kind of trivial sense of that. So there's another problem, that systemic problems around racial injustice, sexual violence, they pop up in the media episodically, but there's far too little sustained comment about the underlying systems. So you can find newspapers writing about, you know, police violence against black and brown people that is unjustified, but you don't hear a lot of talk about white supremacy. You don't hear a lot of talk about the underlying core values of this country. And that's another thing that media in this hyper-commercialized setting are not particularly good at. So, you know, there's a lot to say about Donald Trump that I think we should be saying about the risk he poses, about what we learn about the country from the fact that maybe 40% of the electorate's going to vote for this guy, maybe more. But we should also be able to go to the nature of the system. Donald Trump is, to me, a dangerous presence in the political arena. But in that bigger sense, he's also simply a manifestation of other problems as well that go much, much deeper.
Well, we could have had that debate about white supremacy had Hillary Clinton answered her deplorable the charge against her, where she talked about a basket full of deplorables in relation to Trump's supporters. You know, she was, once again, she apologized, but didn't basically say what she was really talking about was the white supremacists that have flocked to support him, which is pretty clear and on the record.
And there's a lesson in that, you know. The sort of what we typically call the liberal wing of contemporary American society is itself not terribly good at reflecting on these deep systemic problems, because, you know, the Democratic Party has never been very good at calling out the deep white supremacist nature of contemporary society. That doesn't play well with white voters, maybe, they think. And of course, when Bill Clinton and that gang took the Democratic Party to the right in the late 80s and 90s, it used often a very coded racist rhetoric itself. And Hillary Clinton's been called on that for her use of the term super predators to demonize a certain kind of young person in America. So, you know, the political class is all mixed up in using these, deplorable kinds of rhetorics. And therefore, none of them are in a very good position to actually step out and say, this is the nature of the systemic problem. And you know, I don't have answers for how to do that. The standard lefty response is, that's why we need strong movements in the street. That's why we need grassroots movements. That's why we need radical movements that will pressure people in power. We all know the response. And all of that's at some level true. But, you know, when I look at this country and look at how the system does and doesn't respond. I have to say, I'm at a loss to know where the wedges are, where we're going to get traction on these things. I think one thing that seems very healthy for me, or healthy to me for people on the left, is to acknowledge that some of the old ways we've organized don't seem effective anymore, that the ideological terrain is shifting, and that the underlying decline of the systems to some degree changes the landscape on which we organize. And that's not only about politics and economics, it's also, as I said earlier, at a very fundamental level about ecological realities, which the left itself is not terribly good about acknowledging. So to me, I'm scared, terrified, panicked about the possibility of a Trump presidency. Okay, I think that's a rational response to Donald Trump. But I'm also just as scared, terrified of the direction, the trajectory of not only U.S. society, but the world, and not in some far off, centuries to come, but if not within my lifetime, certainly within the lifetime of my kid. And I think we should be talking about those things as well. Sure. It's all relevant. It's all important.
Right. But in our narrow political choices, we're the world's greatest democracy, we're told, and yet we have such narrow political choices. We don't have a full range of politics, both in the media, where you have, from all the way from the far right to the far left represented in the media and in most of the other democracies, and in the political parties. And our alternative parties are absolutely ridiculous. The libertarians, the guy that at the top of the ticket is a complete fool. His own running mate can't stand him and is embarrassed by him and I think wants to get out. And then you've got Jill Stein on the Democratic side, who's a complete ridiculous. I mean, she goes off to Russia with this horrible General Flynn, this nutcase that Trump's dredged up, and they get feted by Putin, for the anniversary of RT, the propaganda outlet.
Yeah.
I mean, so this,
I have to catch up, because when you said the world's greatest democracy, at first I thought you meant Canada. So I had to, so we're talking about the United States, right?
Right.
Okay. Now everything we're talking about, these big trends over time and the effects of, commercial media on journalism, all that stuff is important to talk about. But as you point out, in a month, we all have to make a decision about voting. And on that, I'm very clear. All my confusion and concern at the larger level evaporates, because in presidential elections, people always say, well, we're stuck with the lesser of two evils. And I agree completely. That's the nature of presidential politics. It always has been. And at least in my lifetime, I suspect it always will be. So this idea that somehow one is, capitulating, copping out to vote for the lesser of two evils, I think is actually quite silly. In fact, I think it's morally indefensible to do anything. From my point of view, I'm speaking for myself now, it's morally indefensible to do anything except vote for Hillary Clinton. And the reason I say that is twofold. One is, of course, that a Trump presidency is not just a run-of-the-mill disaster. It's potentially changing the future trajectory of this society, which means changing the future trajectory of the planet, and I don't take that lightly. Another reason is that, as progressives, we're supposed to stand against Islamophobia, against racism, against, sexism, against nativism, against, xenophobia. In other words, we're supposed to stand against everything that Trump not only hints at, but articulates directly, right? And blocking that matters. It's also, I think, important to recognize that it's not trivial that Hillary Clinton, if elected, will be the first female president. When Barack Obama was on the ticket the first time, I didn't agree with much of Barack Obama's politics because he's a centrist Democrat and I don't come from that political position. But I certainly recognize the symbolic importance of this nation being able to elect a person of African descent. And I think the same thing holds with Hillary Clinton. And the other point, as you made, is that the Green Party is not a viable option. When Jill Stein has said, and has said repeatedly, that there's no meaningful difference between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, I think that, to me, says that Jill Stein is not a serious person. The Green Party historically has not built much power from the bottom up. It pops up every 4 years with a presidential candidate and achieves nothing. The Nader debacle should have taught us something, And I think it's a shame that more people didn't learn from that.
Well, Robert Jensen, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Robert Jensen. He's a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the extent to which the GOP is relying on Vladimir Putin and Julian Assange to elect their candidate, Donald Trump, president. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Stephen Pfeiffer, who's the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russian issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine. Sorry, I'm tongue-tied. Let me start all over again here. And joining us now is Stephen Pfeiffer, who's the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russian issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine and Special Assistant to the President, and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pfeiffer.
Thanks for having me.
And how do you explain, or what's your response to this apparent surreal condition that we have now, where the GOP, in order to get their candidate into the White House, Donald Trump, are in effect relying on Vladimir Putin and Julian Assange to leak opposition research on Hillary Clinton?
Well, it's a strange situation. I mean, you had the announcement by the U.S. intelligence community on Friday that put out their conclusion that the hack of the Democratic National Committee, in fact, was done by Russia with the approval of senior Russian officials. I personally am not sure that the goal of the Russians here is to make Mr. Trump the next president of the United States, but I think it may be more aimed at simply promoting a degree of chaos, promoting doubts among the American public in the efficacy and the proper workings of the American democratic system.
And presumably, with a view to their own audience in Russia, Putin is basically saying, I may have taken your democracy away, but look at those hypocrites on the American side. What kind of democracy do they have?
Well, exactly. I mean, you have seen, unfortunately, over the course of Mr. Putin's time in office going back to 2000, steady creeping authoritarianism within Russia. Now, certainly from the perspective of many Russians, the democracy in Russia in the 1990s was far from perfect. It was accompanied by a very severe economic contraction, which had painful consequences for many people. But Mr. Putin's effort to restore order has gone way beyond that now. There's a parliament which is really a rubber stamp body. Increasing restrictions on political life of ordinary Russians. And he's now looking to find ways, I think, to weaken and undermine democracy, not just in the United States, but also in Europe.
So what did you make of the exchange in the debate, Ambassador Pfeiffer, where the Hillary Clinton, where Donald Trump actually defended the Russian and Assad government's activities in Syria, the the bombing, which the UN is referring to as war crime, of civilians in Aleppo. And Trump made the extraordinary statement that Russia, Iran, he supports the Russia and Iran's and Assad's efforts to destroy ISIS, which is not what's happening. That's the problem the U.S. has with Russia, and that's why they can't make a deal. In supporting the Assad regime, Russia is eliminating the opposition that the U.S. and the rest of the West is supporting, and not going after ISIS, which is what he claims to do, because the tactic is clearly to support Assad, bring him back in control of as much of the country as possible, and leave the U.S. holding the bag, which is this untenable group of jihadis that we're supposed to eliminate.
No, that's correct. Actually, I should say in full disclosure, I support Hillary Clinton for president, but I thought that the statement that Mr. Trump made regarding Russian and Syrian activities was one of a number of misstatements he made last night, because it's not true that Russia is directing its military power in Syria against ISIS, nor are the Syrians. You know, the focus since Russia became militarily involved in Syria back in September of 2015 has been to bolster the position of the Syrian government, and that has meant mainly conducting an air campaign, a military campaign, against more moderate groups that the United States, Europe, the Gulf Arab states see as essential to any kind of a negotiated settlement in Syria. They've borne the brunt of the air attacks from the Russian Air Force and the Syrian Air Force. The Russians and Syrians have devoted very little attention relatively to ISIS. And I think Mr. Trump is just ill-informed on that question or just got it wrong.
Well, he was briefed by the intelligence. He was briefed by the intelligence community, and apparently they told him that Russia was hacking us, and he still, in the debate last night, said that's not true. And presumably he was briefed over what's happening in Syria. It's very hard to understand why he's sticking so assiduously to Putin. And clearly, we all know that the exodus of refugees into Europe happened after Putin intervened in Syria. And if the Assad-Iranian-Russian axis is successful in their current campaign, then the Sunnis will be driven into Europe again. And there'll be a massive subsequent refugee flow. And you mentioned earlier Putin's strategy of destabilizing Europe, which seems to be the weaponization of refugees, which he's done once, and it looks like he's going to do again. So he may not be very good for the Russian people, but he certainly knows how to cause mischief and headaches for the Americans.
And this may be, again, driven in part by domestic political considerations in Russia. If you go back and you look at the first two terms of Vladimir Putin as president of Russia from 2000 to 2008, he, by all appearances, justified regime legitimacy, including creeping authoritarianism on the basis of economic performance, where he was able to tell people, you're not going to have much political say, but you're going to see a growing economy, rising living standards. And he was very fortunate in that the price of oil began to rise and the Russian economy prospered for those 8 years. When Mr. Putin came back to the Russian presidency in 2012, the economic situation was far more complex, and he stopped talking about the economy. Instead, he began to talk in terms of Russia as a great power, Russian nationalism, Russia standing up for its place in the world, a very strong dose of anti-Americanism. And so a lot of that is now playing, I think, in his mind in terms of this is how he justifies itself internally at a time when he cannot deliver on the economic side.
But there is, of course, a price that we don't want to pay, and that is the tensions between the U.S. and Russia are clearly getting serious, to the point where the last head of the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev, warned on Monday that we're at a dangerous point. I don't want to give any, quoting him, I don't want to give any concrete prescriptions, but I do want to say that this needs to stop. We need to renew dialogue. Stopping it was the biggest mistake. So you can't really have these two nuclear superpowers not talking to each other.
Well, I think if you look at the Obama administration's policy, While they have correctly, in my view, pushed back against the Russians, for example, on the question of Ukraine and also on Syria, they have also, though, held out the door open for exchanges, for example, further discussions on strategic stability and arms control, which the Russians have not taken up. My judgment is that the Russians, and this gets really down to Vladimir Putin, has decided that he's simply not going to deal with the Obama administration. He's waiting for the next American president, whoever that may be. And therefore, it's going to be hard to try to come up with some sensible steps that might contain some of the risks. So, for example, you've had over the last couple of years a noticeable increase in the number of Russian planes, military planes, and intelligence planes flying near NATO and American airspace. And therefore, because they're normally intercepted and escorted by American and NATO fighters, an increased number of instances where you have close interactions between American, NATO, and Russian military forces. And there have been some close calls. 2 years ago, a Russian plane strayed into a civilian airlane. It did not have its transponder on, and an SAS commercial airliner with 100 people on board had to take emergency action to avoid a mid-air collision. So it would make sense to have some conversations between NATO and Russia on how do you regulate these military activities to avoid accidents, to avoid miscalculations. But the Russians so far don't appear to be interested. Maybe that changes in 2017.
Well, just in closing, Ambassador Pfeiffer, the situation in Syria, though, could end up with even more kinetic action, as they say in the military, where you've got Hillary Clinton calling for a no-fly zone. You've got the U.S. Being humiliated, in effect, by having their proxies bombed, and they can't do anything about it. They can, but they can't. And if they pull the trigger, and Putin's already warned them not to do anything, and he's brought in surface-to-air missiles. So do you foresee anything getting out of control on that front?
I think that there is that risk, but again, I also think both sides understand the risk. And at the end of the day, neither side wants to get into a military conflict over Syria. That calls for care. That calls for, the minimal dialogue that's going on between the Department of Defense and the Russian counterparts on deconflicting air operations. So I think they understand the risk, and they are trying to contain that. But it seems to me in the longer term, and this will be difficult for the Obama administration to do simply because it only has 3 months in office, what's going to have to happen is the United States is going to have to think through, what is its approach to Syria? And that's going to be a hard discussion. I don't pretend to be an expert on Syria, but it's pretty clear, we don't want to put American ground troops in, but are there ways that we can get leverage so you can actually get back to the kind of negotiation that Secretary Kerry was trying to carry out with Foreign Minister Lavrov, where he could actually find a ceasefire arrangement? The problem I think that we had in that negotiation, why it ultimately failed and the Russians paid little attention to it, was we didn't have much leverage. We're going to need leverage if we want to be able to make that kind of negotiation succeed.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, who's the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russian issues. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.